Hello and welcome everyone to our advanced clinical resources for nutritional endocrinology practitioner training. I'm excited to be here today with a special guest, and our topic is one that's near and dear to all of our hearts. It's adrenal fatigue, causes, testing, and treatment. And I want to tell you a little bit about our guest, Dr. Tracy Trancatella. She's a naturopathic doctor, and she specializes in women's health, bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, thyroid and adrenal issues. And she's also a clinical consultant for the BioHealth Laboratory. So she provides physicians and other health professionals with assistance in lab interpretation and with their clinical protocols. So if you're running a test through BioHealth and you call to get assistance with an interpretation, Dr. Trancatella might be the person that you're speaking to. She also provides interpretation and treatment guidelines on a lot of different tests. And this is something you guys want to know about. It's www.labtestsplus.com. And that's a service where they provide the public with access to some of the nutritional and functional medicine testing with a little interpretation so that they understand what's going on. So it might be something that you should look into for your own clients to send them there for the labs that you can't necessarily get through what we've set up for you in the program. I will just let her jump right in and talk about adrenal fatigue. So welcome. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And I would just like to add that, you know, I graduated from naturopathic medical school in 1998, and I've been using BioHealth testing since then. And one of the things that I found, and I've seen other adrenal testing and whatnot, but I found within my own practice that the values on the BioHealth test really seem to correlate well with the symptomatology of my patients and how they're feeling. So I've always felt that their adrenal testing was the most relevant, and in explaining and showing things to my own patients, they really get it because the numbers make sense to them. It really seems to follow their energy patterns and their symptomatology. So I think it's an excellent test, and I've used it since 1998, and it's just as good now as it was then. So I'm happy to talk to you about it today. And just to go over some real basic adrenal fatigue, the causes, which having a brief discussion with Dr. Rita Marie, you guys are pretty familiar with adrenal fatigue and what some of the causes are. So if I go through things that are somewhat repetitive and things that you already know, I apologize. I'll try to move through those things quickly. Because I know as a practitioner, I like to get to the heart of the matter at looking at test interpretation and also treatment protocols, because what's most important for you is your clients and what you can do tomorrow to help them. Right. So that being said, let me go on to our next slide.
And just okay, let me interrupt so right here.
Adrenal glands.
Yeah, I just want to let people know that these slides are uploaded, so you should be able to download the slides and print them if you want to take notes right on the slides.
Okay. All right, so the adrenal glands, as most of you may know, are above the kidneys, and they're often referred to as the suprarenal glands. And so that is the basic location of where they are. And this is the basic structure of the adrenal glands. There's two main parts, that is the cortex and the medulla. And they both have different functions. So the medulla produces something quite different than the cortex. All right, so the adrenal glands are composed of the anterior medulla and the outer cortex. The medulla, being the inner part, produces hormones that are often referred to also as neurotransmitters. Those predominantly are epinephrine, norepinephrine, and a little bit of dopamine. And epinephrine, as we know, is also known as adrenaline, and norepinephrine is also known as noradrenaline. So that is what the medulla produces. The cortex is comprised of three layers, the outer, the middle, and the inner. The outer layer, the zona glomerulosa, produces the aldosterone, and that's primarily responsible for mineral balance. The middle layer, the zona fasciculata, produces the cortisol. The inner layer, the zona reticularis, that produces the DHEA and other androgens. So when the adrenal glands start to falter, we refer to that as adrenal insufficiency or adrenal fatigue. in conventional medicine, it's really only recognized where there are extremes of adrenal fatigue. And when you have complete failure of the adrenal glands, you have Addison's disease. And when you have overproduction of the adrenal hormones, you have Cushing's syndrome. And I'm going to give you a brief description of the clinical presentation of each of those later, because I feel it's important for us as practitioners to be able to identify how that presents when you're looking at a patient and when you're looking at their labs, because there's often some crossover between Addison's and just adrenal fatigue. There's some common things that you will see, so it's important to make note of that. Okay, so let's discuss the adrenal hormones, cortisol, DHEA, and aldosterone. So cortisol, being a glucocorticoid, meaning that it helps to manage glucose and mobilize resources for energy. So it will break down amino acids and fatty acids to be used as fuel for energy production. It will stimulate the liver to convert amino acids to glucose. It also increases glycogen in the liver. Glycogen, as we know, is the storage form of glucose. So when cortisol goes up, it stimulates the breakdown of glycogen so that you can free up glucose and it gets into the blood right away. It also opposes the action of insulin, which is insulin's action is to take glucose into the cells. Well, cortisol wants glucose to stay circulating in the blood, so that's how it opposes the action of insulin. It increases blood pressure. It counteracts inflammation and allergies. It also helps us to tolerate stress, whether it be infections, physical trauma, temperature extremes, or any kind of emotional stress. It also helps us to maintain mood and emotional stability. And as we know, if you've looked at any adrenal testing, it's highest in the morning and it tapers as the day goes on. Okay, so too much cortisol, as we know, is not a good thing, because cortisol is a catabolic hormone. It breaks down things to mobilize for energy. So what happens is you get a reduced cellular utilization of glucose, and you will find that blood sugar levels will increase, because that's part of cortisol's action, is to mobilize glucose and to get it into the blood. But if you have high cortisol for too long, you end up in a hyperglycemic state, and this is not good. So it will decrease protein synthesis, being that it's a catabolic hormone. It stops the formation of proteins, and some of those proteins are our own body tissues. It will increase protein breakdown, and this can lead to muscle loss. You can also have bone loss when you have way elevated cortisol. It can interfere with skin regeneration and healing. Being that cortisol is immunosuppressive, any kind of healing response will become dampened as a result of too much cortisol. Causes shrinking of the lymphatic tissue, and it can diminish lymphocyte numbers and functions. Again, that's just really working on reducing immune function. So DHEA is another adrenal hormone, and this somewhat opposes the effects of cortisol. This is why when we do testing and we look at the ratio of cortisol to DHEA, those numbers are very important, because you need to have enough DHEA around to counterbalance the effect of cortisol. So cortisol, as I said, is catabolic. It breaks down tissue, whereas DHEA is more anabolic. It builds up tissue. So you have to have a balance of both to be in a healthy state. It's also a major precursor of testosterone and estrogen. It reverses the immune suppression of cortisol, so that's one important aspect of it. It stimulates bone deposition. It increases muscle mass. That's the exact opposite of what high levels of cortisol will do. It also supports the thyroid's conversion of T4 to the more active T3. And as you have probably learned, when you have elevated cortisol for too long, it interferes with the conversion of T4 to T3, and you end up with a lot of reverse T3. And on a standard thyroid panel, you would not notice that unless you actually tested for reverse T3, because it will just come back measured as T3 on the test, and those values would look fine. But if it's reverse T3, it's an inactive form of thyroid hormone, so it really has no activity. So DHEA also accelerates the recovery from acute stress, which is very important. It decreases total cholesterol and LDL, and what we're usually measuring on the lab test is the sulfated form of DHEA because it tends to be more stable. Aldosterone, this is also produced by the adrenals, and it helps to regulate mineral balance in the body. This is a mineral of corticoid. And what it does is it promotes the reabsorption of sodium and water in the kidney, and it promotes the excretion of potassium. So it can thereby also increase your blood pressure. It's also produced in a rhythm very similar to cortisol. And it's a very important component of adrenal health because those who have like a stage 2 or stage 3 adrenal fatigue often have orthostatic hypotension or just typically low blood pressure. And this is because they're not producing enough aldosterone to help regulate and maintain a healthy blood pressure. You'll also see people with low aldosterone will typically crave salt. And it's a natural way of your body telling you that you need more sodium, and it's also a way of retaining fluid in the vasculature to keep your blood pressure stable. Okay, so I'd mentioned before that I was going to talk briefly about Cushing syndrome and Addison's disease because I think it's important to recognize the extremes of pathology if you're doing adrenal testing. So with Cushing's syndrome, you get a major overproduction of the adrenal hormones, and signs and symptoms of that would present as a person with a very rounded face. They have a lot of belly fat or truncal obesity. Their arms and legs are very thin because cortisol is typically breaking down the musculature. And the reason for the truncal obesity is that it's just redistributing fat to the torso. They will often have what's called a buffalo hump, just this sort of fat pad at the lower base of their neck and their upper back. They will have acne, and that's likely because of increased androgen production, fatigue, high blood pressure. As we know, we just talked about how cortisol can cause vasoconstriction, and that's why the blood pressure goes up. They have elevated blood glucose because of cortisol's ability to mobilize stored sugars, and you get bone loss because of the breakdown effect of cortisol. And some of the psychiatric symptoms that you might see, depression, anxiety, loss of emotional control, cognitive difficulties, and these are kind of interesting because you will see those symptoms also with just some mild adrenal fatigue. So it's important to make note of that as you're assessing your patient. So with Addison's disease, this is a complete failure of the adrenal glands, and there could be a number of reasons for Addison's disease. It could be primary, meaning that there is either a tumor in the adrenals or just complete failure due to medication. It could be secondary due to a pituitary issue. So, you know, if you ever see somebody who seems to present in this way, you probably want to refer them off to an endocrinologist for a more thorough evaluation because you're going to want to determine what the cause of the Addison's disease is. So, excuse me, I'll take a drink of water. So this is when the adrenal glands fail to produce their hormones. So you will typically see weakness, fatigue, low blood pressure, salt cravings, low blood sugar, and abdominal and joint pain. And it's likely because the cortisol is very low and they just tend to not move things around very well. The joints kind of get swollen and become painful. Another interesting presentation, which I didn't note here, is that people with primary Addison's disease will have kind of this orangey tan skin. And that has to do with the fact that if you've got really low cortisol, you're trying to feed back to the pituitary that the cortisol is low, and you're trying to get the pituitary to stimulate the adrenals to produce more cortisol. The hormone that stimulates the adrenals is ACTH, and it is produced from another hormone that is also a precursor for melanin. And so by way of stimulating the ACTH loop, you're also putting a demand on the production of this precursor hormone, and it's also contributing to making more melanin. And so the skin becomes kind of blotchy, tan, and kind of orangey, usually on the flexor surfaces like the elbows and the knees, but it can be all over their body and on their face as well, so that's an interesting thing to note. Psychiatric symptoms, anxiety, mood and personality changes, depression, psychosis and delirium, rare but can be seen in very severe cases because they're completely lacking in adrenal hormones, which are so important to keep our body stable throughout the day. Okay, so common signs and symptoms of adrenal fatigue, which you're probably somewhat familiar with. I like to talk about the forms of stress because we really, when we think of stress, most of us immediately go to the mental emotional aspect of stress. And while that does play a significant role in our daily stress level, there are other things that we need to consider as well. There are physical stressors, any kind of fracture, muscle injury, nerve compression. So injuries in general are a stressor that your body has to adapt to. Poor glucose management, this is a really big one. And part of the reason why in addressing adrenal fatigue, we have to address dietary and lifestyle issues. We have to look at glucose management. We have to look at diet. Is it balanced? Are they eating a lot of high glycemic foods? And if so, they're putting stress on their adrenal glands because you're constantly trying to keep your blood sugar stable, and cortisol plays a huge role in that. So if you don't have a healthy diet and you have poor blood sugar management, that is a major stressor on your adrenals. Nutrient deficiencies, B vitamins, vitamin C, minerals, all can put a stress on the adrenal glands. Chemical exposures, whether it's pollutants, smoke, heavy metals, drugs, toxic food, anything that we could be exposed to, which most of us are exposed to at some level on a daily basis. So these are also stressors that we all have to contend with. Other things like job, family, work, those are all stressors as well. So causes of adrenal fatigue, I've tried to put these as a list sort of in a category. The first, let's see, four or five are all more mental emotional stressors and causes of adrenal fatigue. The next few are more like physical issues, excessive exercise. I live here in Bend, Oregon, and I live amongst a lot of people who do a lot of extreme endurance activities. Their adrenal glands are shot. When you look at the adrenal tests of people who do a lot of endurance exercise, it's a major stressor for the adrenals and is not really healthy from a broader perspective. Sleep deprivation, that's a huge one. When you're addressing adrenal fatigue, one of the main things you want to get lined up and in place is to try to get your patients to sleep better. Not only better, but more hours. Usually most of us are not getting enough sleep, so that is a huge part of recovering adrenals. I always tell practitioners when I'm talking to them that if you can't get your patients to sleep well, you're going to have a really hard time recovering their adrenals. All right, so light cycle disruption, this is likely, you know, sleeping with too many lights on, a lot of blue light exposure late in the day. These are things to consider, and I often address that in terms of sleep hygiene, addressing those issues with your clients and your patients, because some of them just don't think about, you know, staying up on the computer and then thinking that they're going to go to bed right away. So, you know, give those considerations. They're very important. Late hours, surgery, trauma, I think those are self-explanatory. Chronic inflammation, whether it be from autoimmune diseases or just an inflammatory diet. Infections, that's a big part of what we talk about. If you can't get somebody to recover their adrenals very well and they don't seem to be responding to a well-chosen protocol, you want to go start looking for underlying causes. And very often, this could be related to chronic infections, whether they be bowel infections or a heavy viral load, all of those things can be a stressor on the adrenal glands. Temperature extremes, these are more environmental aspects, which I think we're all aware of. Poor digestion, malabsorption, not digesting your food properly, creating more of an inflammatory state in the gut, and not absorbing the nutrients from your food can be a stressor as well. Okay, so I think the others are kind of self-explanatory, so let's move on to the next slide. So common signs of adrenal fatigue. And, you know, we've all seen the lists, and this is just kind of a condensed version of that. But, you know, I know that in my own practice, by the time somebody walks into my door, I know that adrenal fatigue is playing a role in their symptomatology. And so I do adrenal testing on just about every patient. And that, in addition to dietary changes and a lot of other things, can make a huge difference in the way they feel. So the common presentation that you would see is usually the number one complaint is excessive fatigue. And it may be fatigue all day, or there may be certain points in the day where they're fatigued, weakness, low body temperature, brain fog, inability to concentrate, inability to tolerate stress, an increase in allergies for sure, because we know that cortisol suppresses the immune response. And so when you start to see increasing allergies, it may be due to the fact that your body's natural anti-inflammatory is low. You have low cortisol. Headaches, dizziness upon standing, this goes back to the issue with aldosterone. And it's regulating blood pressure through mineral balance. Heart palpitations are common. Immune deficiency, that's usually due to low DHEA. PMS and menstrual changes, that's a huge one because, and that's what will usually bring women into the office because they start to see their cycle change. It will either get heavier or shorter. They may have overall more PMS symptoms. And this is likely because of the imbalance that adrenal fatigue can cause with the sex hormones. You know, when we have to respond to a stressor, it's an in-the-moment response. It's not something that we can put on the back burner. It's like instantaneous. So the body will put sex hormone production on the back burner and push everything more towards cortisol because that is what is responsible for that fight-or-flight response. We have to respond to something in the moment, and we can't wait. So if those in-the-moment fight-or-flight stimulus happens frequently throughout the day, eventually the sex hormones are going to take a hit because of that. Insomnia, that's usually a big one. And you would think that patients who have low cortisol would sleep like a baby at night. But the opposite is often true. When you start to see people head into more of a stage 2 adrenal fatigue where they have varied values throughout the day, maybe both high and low, they end up not sleeping well at night. It's almost like they get this second wind and they try and make up for all the energy they didn't have during the day. That's a typical pattern that I see. So they'll end up staying up too late. And then when they go to bed, they can't seem to turn off their mind. So insomnia is a big issue. And when you see it with stage 3 adrenal fatigue, where cortisol is very low and DHEA is very low, that's even more concerning because everything is bottoming out. And that adrenal rhythm that you're supposed to see throughout the day where it starts high and goes low tends to flatline. And they don't have, in order for you to have the lows, you have to have the highs. You have to have a good output of cortisol in order to stimulate other things to happen later in the day. So that's a very important thing to consider when you're looking at the graph on the test, which I'll show you later. You can compare a person's values to what is normal, and you can look at the rhythm throughout the day. So hypoglycemia, yes, obviously. If you don't have enough cortisol to help you mobilize glucose, you're going to have bouts of hypoglycemia. Cravings for caffeine and sweets. This is a person's desire to keep themselves going because they're feeling a level of fatigue and perhaps low blood pressure that they need to try and keep themselves going through caffeine and sugar, something readily available to put some to raise their blood sugar. Cravings for salt, I think we touched upon with the aldosterone deficiency. Digestive disorders, common. Diminished sex drive, and that has to do with the imbalance in the sex hormones. Reduced perspiration, this is related to aldosterone. And muscle spasms, this has more to do with mineral imbalances as they relate to adrenal functions. And this is partly why part of the protocols that we use at BioHealth always involve using a multi-mineral complex. Okay, so perceptions of stress. The number one cause of dysfunctional cortisol stress response is the mental-emotional aspect. So this is why when we think of stress, we always think of the mental-emotional part of it. You know, it's really how we perceive an event rather than the event itself that will induce a stress response. You know, I often tell patients that the feeling of being excited about something and the feeling of being fearful has the same physiological reaction. It's just your mental association with it. So, you know, in order to address our physical response to stressors, we have to take control of our mental state and learn how to manage stress better so that we don't set off that major stress response and get everything rolling, because once it's rolling, it's got to work itself all the way out. The second cause of dysfunctional cortisol stress response is imbalanced blood sugar. And I touched on this briefly. Simple carbohydrates, way too many of them, which is kind of typical of the American diet, really can mess up your blood sugar throughout the day. It can cause your blood sugar to go high, and then you get a reactive hypoglycemia later, and that just sets you off on those cravings. And it also stimulates the output of cortisol to try to stabilize your blood sugar, because when your blood sugar goes low, cortisol goes up to stimulate the breakdown of glycogen in the liver so you can dump some glucose into the blood and keep your blood sugar stable. And that's a lot of work. That's an undue stress on the adrenal glands that it doesn't really have to endure if you eat a good diet and you manage your blood sugar throughout the day. Third cause of dysfunctional cortisol responses is pretty much everything else, and we'd already touched on some of those stressors early on. But these are the things that we control, which I think that's why it's so important to address these with your patients and clients, because you can talk about the mental-emotional aspect. And you can talk about the dietary aspect and make changes in those realms to help them stabilize their energy and bring their adrenals back. Mental emotional stressors, your perception, as I said, of the event will trigger that positive or negative response. And this results in electrical changes in the heart and the nervous system. You get a major stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system when you perceive a stressful event. So this ultimately can suppress immune response and hormonal responses, and you end up with imbalanced states later on. The overstimulation of the sympathetic nervous system can result in a reduction of secretory IgA, which is your immune response. It's your frontline immune response along all of your mucosal membranes, so your mouth, your nose, your sinuses, your respiratory tract, and your GI tract. And these areas are the interface between us and the world around us. So you've got to have good SIG-A response in order to react against any kind of bacteria or virus that you're exposed to. If you don't have good secretory IgA levels, your frontline immune defense is down, and it allows for you to get sick a lot easier. Okay, so here's secretory IgA, primary immunoglobulin on your mucosal surfaces. You know, it neutralizes viruses and bacteria at the site of initial infection, which is why it's so important. If you have good SIG-A output, you can encounter viruses and bacteria, and your body will neutralize it. This is why some people who have really healthy, robust immune systems don't get sick when they're surrounded by other people who seem to be spreading germs around them all the time. The good thing about the SIG-A response is it's not an inflammatory response, whereas a cytokine response, it promotes inflammation. So this is why secretory IgA is so important. It's like the door that keeps everything out. So it gets reduced during the production of stress, and elevated cortisol to DHEA ratio contributes to the decreased production of secretory IgA, which is why this is one of the values that we measure on the adrenal stress profile, so that you can look at that ratio. Bosegay contributes to the progression of adrenal fatigue by suppressing a healthy response to pathogens. So again, it's like feeding into this vicious cycle. You have adrenal fatigue and stress that continues to promote that adrenal fatigue. You suppress secretory IgA, you're more prone to bacteria, viruses, and other pathogens, maybe parasitic infections, and that further adds to your adrenal fatigue. So it's a cycle that you have to step in and try and stop at some level. So the cortisol to DHEA ratio. So as I was saying, cortisol is a catabolic hormone. It breaks down tissue to be used for energy. It also suppresses the immune response, whereas DHEA is an anabolic hormone. It builds up bone and muscle, and it opposes the effects of cortisol. It also supports an immune response. In addition to a lot of other things, you have to have healthy DHEA levels to have a healthy immune response. So they have to exist in a proper ratio, and typically on our tests, it's like a 5-to-6-to-1 ratio that we like to see cortisol to DHEA. So if cortisol dominates, we maintain a catabolic state. And again, going back to the extreme of that is a Cushingoid patient with very skinny arms and legs. They're basically breaking down tissue, and that's not something that you want, especially as we all get older. So these are different systems that ratio can affect, and I'm not going to read all of them off to you. You guys have the slides, so you can just use this as a reference. But these are all the symptoms: glucose management, eicosanoid modulation, which is related to states of inflammation, our ability to detoxify, how we metabolize fat and protein, other endocrine organs, the pancreas, the thyroid, ovarian output of hormones, neural tissue. All of these are related to that ratio of cortisol to DHEA. If it's too weighted towards cortisol, you get dysfunction in these systems. Okay. So the chronic stress response. This is basically, we're looking at the hypothalamic pituitary axis, and it's basically the control center for your endocrine system. And so when you have cells in the hypothalamus that will produce corticotropin-releasing factor in response to any kind of physical or psychological stress, it's that stimulus that goes out to the pituitary to produce ACTH, and then the ACTH goes to the adrenal glands to stimulate the production of the adrenal hormones. And the endocrine system, I always find it really interesting just how it functions on this feedback loop. You know, you have a stimulus, it goes to the target organ, the organ puts out its respective hormones, the presence of those hormones turns down the volume on the stimulus. And that's basically what this slide is showing. You know, it's just showing the input as being the stressor, going into the hypothalamus stimulates the pituitary stimulates the adrenals, and then you have the output of the hormones. The presence of those hormones dampens that response. Okay, so with that response, we have two major systems. We have catecholamine output and we have cortisol. So the catecholamines, this is produced by the medulla of the adrenal gland. This is where you have epinephrine and norepinephrine. That's the adrenaline rush that you get when you encounter something that is a major stressor immediately. I always use the analogy of like a near-miss car accident. You can feel your adrenal glands releasing adrenaline. You can actually feel it. It happens that instantaneously. Then you have the cortisol response, which mobilizes glucose to fuel that reaction. That's the fight or flight response that you're experiencing right there. And in order to keep that going and to support that response, you've got to mobilize sugar to keep everything going, to feed the muscles and to get it all going. So the catecholamines, what they do is they'll increase your heart rate. They increase the return of blood to the heart. They increase the blood volume that you can pump from your heart, and they increase blood pressure. They dilate blood vessels of the skeletal muscle. So what happens is you get a constriction of blood vessels that go to the major organs, but you get a dilation of blood vessels in the skeletal muscle because this is readying you for action. And when you think about it, it's a very primitive response. You know, this fight or flight response is what saves our life very often. You know, when we go back to the so-called caveman days when we had to, our stressors were running for our lives from something, you had to elicit this response to have the physical capacity to respond. So we increase blood sugar, decrease insulin release from the pancreas because we want to keep the glucose in the blood. We prevent glucose uptake from peripheral tissues, so it keeps it in circulation. Increase fatty acids and cholesterol in the bloodstream. That is also mobilization for use of energy. And so the overall effect is to mobilize energy to fuel this fight or flight response. So with cortisol, I think I've really touched on this a lot, so I am going to just pick out the pieces which I haven't addressed. So it suppresses gastric emptying and slows digestion. And that's part of the sympathetic nervous system, is that when your sympathetic nervous system is activated, you have that response of mobilizing everything for that fight or flight response. Digestion is not important in that moment. Blood circulation to the major organs, it becomes secondary. It's all going out to the skeletal muscle so that you can respond. So emptying, gastric emptying, slowing digestion, and you'll often see in people who are chronically stressed, they tend to be constipated or have bowel issues. So linking that response back to the cortisol response, I think, is important. Increases blood pressure, suppresses immune function, and this whole process can deplete the body of magnesium, zinc, glutamine, and carnitine. So this is just a diagram of the chronic stress response, and this is something that BioHealth put together years ago. So you kind of read it from left to right and from top down. And so I'm not going to go over this really because I think it's just a picture of what happens when you stimulate the sympathetic nervous system and the hypothalamic pituitary response and what the consequences of all of that may be. And that is all here written in blue. And so this is a good thing to refer to because you will often see this, some of these symptoms with your patients. And again, this is more of a picture of what is going on here. These are the stressors, the input towards the ACTH, sympathetic overflow, blood sugar dysregulation, any kind of pain stimulates the production of ACTH and increases cortisol output. Okay, so here's the fun part where we get into testing and treatment. So, you know, BioHealth does saliva testing, and I really feel that saliva testing is the only way to go when you're doing adrenal hormone testing because you cannot test a rhythm through serum samples. And with a serum sample, you're basically getting the free and the bound cortisol. And the only active portion of the cortisol is the one that is free. So the adrenal saliva testing is the free fraction of the hormone. And we can get several measurements throughout the day. So we do typically 4 samples throughout the day, and it allows you to see the rhythm of their cortisol production. What I've often seen, too, is in serum testing, it can also look pretty normal because you've got a lot of bound cortisol that is also being measured. And if somebody is only evaluating the adrenal glands by that morning cortisol value, things can definitely be missed. And quite often, the morning value can be normal, as you will see sometimes on saliva testing. But other values throughout the day are not normal, and those tend to correlate with how the patient is feeling and their level of fatigue throughout the day. So we talk about adrenal fatigue as a progression of stages. And so when we refer to test results, we'll usually say, well, it's stage one, stage two, or stage three. And more so in the past did these stages direct treatment protocols. But, you know, I tell practitioners that you really have to put these numbers within the context of your patient history to make them come alive. You're not treating just the numbers on the test. You're treating the patient. So you have to always look at the test results and look at the history of the patient. If they tend to be a very sensitive patient, they're sensitive to supplements, and they're in a stage two adrenal fatigue, you might have to go light on supplementation and treatment for them initially because they may be too reactive to anything that you give them. So, you know, we have formulas put together, we have guidelines, and we have protocols, but none of that is set in stone. We still have to think clinically about how we want to approach each individual patient. So normal adrenal function, if you were going to be looking at a test, would look something like this. You would see a cortisol sum that is well within the normal reference range. That the cortisol throughout the day are within the normal range. So the total is normal, and each individual value is well within the normal reference range. That the DHEA is at a good level, ideally between 6 to 8. The reference range measures from 2 to 10. And that when you do the ratio, which is basically taking the total cortisol and dividing it by the DHEA, that gives you the ratio there. You want to see a 5-to-6-to-1 ratio. Okay. All right, so here is a test of a normal person. I've seen very few of these in terms of initial testing. So you'd like to see that morning cortisol around 18 would be ideal. And so you can see that these individual values are like mid-range or in the upper third of the range, and that the total cortisol sum is above 30, and that they have a good level of DHEA. And as you can see, the ratio is between 5 to 6. So this is an ideal value. And as you can see on the graph below, the yellow line represents the values on the test. So the green and the red lines represent the low and the high ends of the reference range. So you want to see your patient in there somewhere. And what I was mentioning before about patients who flatline, it's best represented on the graph. You can see that all the values are very similar, and it just tends to be a straight line throughout the day. And that's not a good thing to see because, as I said, you need the highs of cortisol to have the lows and to induce a sleepy state in the evening. Okay, so stage one, adrenal fatigue. And I think, you know, the staging at this point is more a way for us to communicate what the numbers say on the test rather than, you know, where a patient is or was and where they're going. We don't necessarily know that if a patient comes to us and their test result looks like a stage two, we don't necessarily know if they went through stage one to get to stage two. We just know where they are at that point in time. So with a stage one adrenal fatigue, you will see an increased output of ACTH because there's more stress coming in and there's more stimulus, more pituitary production to stimulate the adrenals to put out cortisol. You will typically see a low DHEA level, a low or low normal, because so much cortisol is being driven, or so many of those precursor hormones are being driven towards cortisol production, that DHEA will start to drop off. And that's what you will typically see in a stage one adrenal fatigue. And you will typically see elevated individual values. You may have an elevated total cortisol, but you'll see elevated individual values, and you may see an elevated nighttime cortisol. And, you know, it's funny, you don't see a lot of people in stage one adrenal fatigue. I've seen maybe only a handful in my own practice because they kind of think they're doing okay. They don't feel bad yet. And they're not bothered by the fact that maybe they're getting less sleep because they're kind of on this adrenaline rush. but it can only last for so long. And so you'll see most of your patients and clients in stage 2 and stage 3 adrenal fatigue. So here's what a stage 1 profile might look like. The first thing I look at is the cortisol sum. You can see that's elevated. And then I go back and look at the individual values. Okay, so they've got an elevated morning cortisol, normal noon, normal afternoon, even maybe inching towards being low, and then really high nighttime cortisol. So this is not a good place to be in because this person is probably not sleeping very well. And that's a bad thing. Eventually, these numbers are going to all start to come down and get a lot lower, and they're going to really feel it. When you see an elevated morning cortisol like this, there's two things to think about. One is that they may have blood sugar issues throughout the night, that they're experiencing hypoglycemic episodes, so cortisol is coming up to try and stabilize glucose while they're sleeping. Or you may be looking at a parasitic infection that can cause morning cortisol to be elevated. And as you can see, the DHEA is at the lower end of normal there. So people generally don't stay in this state for very long because the adrenals can't keep up, and they will eventually progress to a stage 2. But that's not to say that everybody you see in a stage 2 has progressed through stage 1. They may just, you know, have some adrenal fatigue and the cortisol production drops off without being extremely elevated to begin with. So in stage 2 adrenal fatigue, this is more of an intermediate stage. You're still putting pressure on the pituitary to put out the ACTH. The adrenals are somewhat responding by trying to put out cortisol, but they're not as good as they were in a stage 1 adrenal fatigue. So you'll see a low or borderline low morning, noon, or afternoon cortisol level. So again, you have to go a little deeper and look into the individual values because you may have a normal total cortisol, but the individual values throughout the day are anything but normal. So you can still see a normal night. You'll see a normal nighttime cortisol level. They may or may not be having sleep issues at this point, but they are still in a state of pregnenolone steal because the DHEA is typically going to be low or low normal. So here's an example of a stage 2. So the cortisol sum is normal. It's within the reference range, but when you look at the individual values, that morning value, 13.5, to me, is really low because when you have a reference range of 13 to 24, you're looking to be mid-range, not just inside the low end. So to me, that would be low. Noontime is okay, afternoon is okay, and nighttime is okay, but you see this patient starting to inch towards a stage 2. And the fact that they have a really low DHEA output is significant here. And if you were to treat this person appropriately and then retest in 3 or 4 months, those individual values of cortisol may or may not change too much, but you would likely see the DHEA start to come up. And that's a good sign. A lot of people overlook the fact that the DHEA is coming up because they're so focused on the cortisol. But really, you do want to see that DHEA come up and have that ratio change because that is a significant improvement. And patients are usually at that point, when they see the DHEA start coming up, are starting to feel better. So this is stage 3 adrenal fatigue where everything is just starting to wane. Your adrenals just aren't responding to the stimulation anymore. So the overall output is low. So everything is just depleted, really. DHEA is low, cortisol is low, and if you're looking further at sex hormones and everything, those might be low as well. And here's what that might look like. So, you know, you have low values throughout the day. The cortisol sum is very low, 11.9, and the DHEA is low. So this person is not feeling well, and they have a long way to go. And if you have a person within this state who is not sleeping well, the job one is to get them sleeping better because it's going to be very hard to recover their adrenals at this stage if they can't sleep. So I really focus on quality sleep and sleep hygiene issues with patients and as a discussion with other doctors because it's key to recovery. Okay, so recommendations and supplement options. I'm going to talk about just some basic things that you may all be aware of already, and then I'm going to go over some of the Biomatrix supplements. This is an affiliate company to BioHealth. They have some of their own products, and they carry products from other companies as well. And on Biomatrix, they've tried to provide products that will address any findings on their test results. So they have a good line of products there. And I've used their adrenal support products basically since I've been doing their testing, and I've found them to be very effective. So as general recommendations for addressing adrenal exhaustion, lifestyle management, strict dietary glycemic control. So we always have to discuss diet with our patients. And that's a time-consuming process, and it really depends on what your field is. If you're a nutritionist, you can go into a lot more detail. You know, if you're trying to work on other things with a patient, you may have to have a series of formulated handouts and things you can use to educate them. I often refer patients to books that have simple programs that they can follow, and that also gives them an opportunity to educate themselves on why glycemic control is so important. So I'll usually make a book recommendation. One of my go-to books is The Rosedale Diet. It's an older book. It's been around for a while, but, you know, it's clear-cut, straightforward, and most people seem to follow it very well and seem to do well with it. Mental-emotional stress reduction. I work a lot with handouts and things, so I have things pre-printed that I give to patients as ideas and things that they can work on at home. So much of what we do is educating our patients and our clients that we have to have things readily available to us that we can give them to take home and to work on. Because we're really partners in their healthcare, and our job is to give them the tools that they need to get to where they need to be. So handouts always work, book recommendations, anything to help them learn how to deal with stress more effectively. Bedtime by 10 o'clock. Ideally, getting to bed by 10 is great, because between the hours of 10 and 2 is when all these great things happen hormonally, where you're putting out more growth hormone, you're putting out all of these rejuvenative hormones. Your body is healing and recovering from the day between the hours of 10 and 2. So it's really vital to get as much of that, of those hours as you can, and get to bed at a reasonable hour to take advantage of that. Exercise, when you've got somebody in a stage 3, you may have to limit exercise to walking and stretching. As they recover and start to feel better, they can increase their the intensity of their exercise, but really you have to evaluate where they are. Somebody in an extreme state of adrenal fatigue does not recover well from intense exercise, and it really sets them back. So you've got to build them up before they can get out there and really exercise with a certain level of intensity. So retesting protocol, we will typically say after 12 weeks, you can rerun an adrenal stress profile. You know, so that's a good recommendation. However, what I do tell docs a lot is you have to clinically evaluate the patient. Where are they? And are they significantly improved? And do you see those improvements as being consistent over time? Are they good every day, or are they having just two good days out of the week? If they're not quite where you want them to be, you may want to wait on retesting and just continue treating them and working on underlying issues. The other thing to consider, too, is if they're not responding to a well-chosen protocol, and they just don't seem to be making any progress, you've got to evaluate some unseen stressors, whether that be infections, gut issues, dietary issues, food allergies. All of these things have to come into play because those are stressors. And if they've addressed the glycemic control and they're sleeping well and they're doing all of those things that you told them to do, but they're still not making progress, you've got to dig a little bit deeper. Another thing to consider is if somebody doesn't respond to a good adrenal program is whether or not they can actually produce energy at the cellular level. You may have to give them some kind of mitochondrial support to support the cell's ability to actually make ATP, which is sort of a bundled form of energy that the body uses. And And if they're not able to make that, they're very fatigued on a deep level, and that's usually a component of chronic fatigue. So keep that in mind when you're evaluating your patients and how they're responding to therapy. All right, so a basic adrenal protocol with some of the Biomatrix products. We have support adrenals, pregnenolone, DHEA, licorice root, and minerals. The support adrenals, it's an encapsulated product. It's a lot of B vitamins. It's got some adaptogenic herbs. It also has some pregnenolone and DHEA, only about 8 milligrams per 2 capsules of each. So you can get an oral form of the pregnenolone and DHEA as part of the protocol. It's also a great product for maintenance. Once you get people to where they need to be, keeping them on some support adrenals as maintenance is a good way to go. Pregnenolone, this is the mother hormone, the hormonal precursor to all of the other steroid hormones. So what we're doing when we're supplementing with it is we're feeding those pathways. We don't know where it's going to go, but we want it to go where the body needs it to go. So Biomatrix has a liquid product, an alcohol-based product that you can take sublingually. So with the sublingual product, you get really great absorption. It's about 90-95% absorption. It's better than an oral product in that you only get about 60% of what you're taking orally because you're getting a first pass through the liver. Some of it's getting bound up, may not be getting fully absorbed in the digestive tract. So when you do the pregnenolone sublingually, you're getting a lot more of it. And the nice thing about the drops and what I really like is that you can dose very low and you can dose at higher levels and you can adjust dosing in very small amounts by just increasing or decreasing by a drop or two. And each of the pregnenolone has got 1.2 milligrams per drop. So it's a nice way to have some real fine control over how you're dosing your patients, especially people who are very sensitive. It is an alcohol-based product, though, as is the DHEA, so you should always, you know, make sure that your patients can have alcohol. If they're a recovering alcoholic, obviously you can't do the sublinguals because they're alcohol-based. The DHEA, same thing, you know, typically 2 to 4 drops sublingually 3 times a day after meals. And the dosages vary. This is just a general basic protocol. You can increase the drops, decrease the drops according to your patient's needs. The licorice root extract, that is kind of like an herbal form of aldosterone. You know, aldosterone helps us to retain sodium in fluid and excrete potassium. And that's what licorice root does. So this is contraindicated in anybody who has hypertension. You can't use licorice root extract because if they're hypertensive, you can make their hypertension worse by helping them to retain more sodium. We don't want to do that. But what it also does is it prolongs the half-life of cortisol. So if you have patients who have a drop in cortisol midday, you'd want to dose some licorice root extract a few hours before you see that drop off to see if you can sustain that cortisol a little longer in the day. And then lastly, we use support minerals, which is just a multi-mineral complex that we have patients take at night before bed. It tends to help calm them down, relax them, their body and their muscles, and it also supports the adrenals. So here's the support adrenals, and there's a basic description of what's in it. You can always go on to Biomatrix One and view the products and all of the ingredients. Typical dosage is 1 to 2 capsules with breakfast and lunch. And here is the licorice root extract, and I have a brief description over here of what it does, which I think I've touched on. One drop contains about 35 milligrams of licorice root extract with 0.72 milligrams of glycyrrhizin, which is the active ingredient. So again, with the drops and the liquid formulas, you can give a very small dosage if you need to for your very sensitive patients. Support glucose, this is one I didn't mention in the general protocol, but going back to the need to have good blood sugar management, Oftentimes, patients will need something to help stabilize their blood sugar until they really get on track with the diet. So this has some stabilizing herbs. It's got nutrients that help to keep blood sugar stable throughout the day. And the dose is typically one capsule with each main meal. Here's the pregnenolone. It tastes pretty good. I like the taste of it. It's kind of got a vanilla kind of color to it. It looks kind of cloudy, milky in the bottle. You have to shake it up a little bit. It's a little milder than the DHEA in terms of its alcohol content. I tolerate it very well when I take it under my tongue. The DHEA tends to be a little stronger. And I'll often tell patients to combine both at the same time. So put the pregnenolone under your tongue and then add the DHEA, because you're usually taking fewer drops of the DHEA than you are the pregnenolone. And you want to hold it under your tongue for 2 minutes and then just swish it around and swallow. So you want to optimize the contact with those large blood vessels under your tongue by holding it there for a few minutes before you swallow it down. So here's the DHEA, same. The bottles are the same size. The DHEA tends to last a little bit longer than the pregnenolone because you're using more pregnenolone. But it's important to remember, too, that with DHEA being a precursor to testosterone and estrogen, if you have patients who come back with high testosterone or high estrogen, if you're doing a more expanded profile that includes the sex hormones, DHEA may be contraindicated under those circumstances until you can figure out why their sex hormones are elevated. So, you just have to use a little bit of caution with that. And I always try to assess from my patients, if you have a female patient or a male patient for that matter that tends towards acne, or oily skin, you may want to be careful with the DHEA because it may make that worse. So, you can test it out on them and see by doing maybe one or two drops a few times a day. But if it tends to make their skin worse, then it's probably best not to use it. Even if they have low DHEA, you're just going to have to try and raise it by maybe using a little bit more pregnenolone and feeding those pathways. So patients aren't generally very happy if you make their acne worse. So, there's other options out there. There's 7-keto DHEA, but I've just heard that sometimes it can promote acne, other times it can't. It doesn't tend to convert away to testosterone or estrogen, so it is a potential option. We don't carry it on the website, but I'm sure plenty of other supplement companies do carry the 7-keto DHEA. And this is the support minerals. These are fairly large tablets because we don't use a lot of binders to condense the product and make it smaller. So it does dissolve and absorb fairly quickly. So dosage for that is 3 tablets at bedtime. So for those of you who are new to treating adrenal fatigue, a nice thing that's available on the Biomatrix One website, and here is the web address right here, is that if you establish an account as a practitioner, you can access treatment protocols for stage 1, 2, and 3 adrenal fatigue. So it gives you some numbers. It tells you how much of a product to use. And so it just gives you a basis, a starting point, if you're not really sure how to dose things. It's a good place to start. We all start out with guidelines and protocols until we get a better sense of things, and then maybe we venture from those later on as we become more experienced. But the nice thing is that the protocols are available on the website, and if you have trouble accessing them, you can always contact me through tech support, and I can kind of walk you through the process and show you where everything is. So that's Biomatrix One. And just to touch on BioHealth as a laboratory, they've been specializing in saliva testing and functional medicine testing since 1999. And they do a great job with the adrenal testing. I just feel that they're, in my opinion and my experience with my own patients, a more accurate representation of the symptomatology of the patient. And the patients can relate to those numbers. When they see it on paper, they're like, oh, yeah, I really do get fatigued in the afternoon. Or, yeah, I really get a second wind at night, you know, if they've got an elevated nighttime cortisol. So they can kind of see it played out, and they connect with it more. That's what I like. So in addition to the salivary, adrenal, and hormone profiles, we also do a urinary metabolic profile, which measures endocrine levels, which is a marker that can tell you whether or not you're digesting proteins well. Does a UBAS test, which is looking at liver function, and also some antioxidant markers. So just to tell you some really basic things about metabolic function. We also do GI pathogen screening, which is a stool test where you collect 4 samples. And BioHealth is excellent at isolating pathogens, bar none. Of any other labs out there, they are the best at finding parasites.
Yep.
So, you know, when you've got somebody who's got gut issues and you've done all kinds of, like, CDSAs and other things to evaluate digestion, and you're trying to treat based off of those tests and maybe you're not getting anywhere with them, you have to rule out infections first, because the presence of the infections may be contributing to all of the other issues that they're having with their digestion. So first thing is to isolate pathogens and treat them appropriately. And so we can help people interpret the GI pathogen screen as well and come up with some appropriate protocols for treatment. And they're going to be bringing back their measure of secretory IgA, which I touched on briefly, is our frontline immune defense. And so we want to know, how is that functioning? Are we able to fend things off as well as we should be? And so we can give a measure of that as well. So their packaging and everything is, they have updated it in the past couple of years to attain better specimens. And they also offer tech support every day of the week. So Monday through Friday, we offer tech support, which is lab advising. We can go over lab results with people. We can help them come up with protocols. And we always ask for patient history, because what we want to do is help the clients to see the relationship between these test results and their patient's history, so that it really comes to life. And for me, that's really the fun part, because otherwise it's just a bunch of numbers. Mm. So anyway, that is what I have to say about adrenal fatigue. Hopefully you learned something new today that you didn't already know, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, and I'm going to just hone in and say that I find that the GI pathogen screen definitely catches things that other labs miss, so I really appreciate that, and I'm excited that they are going to be bringing back the secretory IgA.
Yeah, I think it's useful for a lot of people to be able to relate what's going on with their adrenals to what's going on with their secretory IgA levels as well, so it's an important aspect.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yes. It's like Laura has a question. Hi, Laura.
Hi. This is such great information.
Great.
I just wanted to ask, as far as the support adrenals, you had mentioned that it was a great one to take for maintenance. How long do you have clients take that for maintenance? For, like, are we talking indefinitely for a couple years?
Well, you know, again, it goes back to your patient's history and what's going on in their lives. You know, I don't think any of us are without any stressors. And if you've been able to pull them back from pretty severe adrenal fatigue, I would probably keep them on the product for about a year. It also depends on their age, because, you know, as we approach middle age and hormones start to drop off in both men and women, people may do better with a little bit of those precursor hormones around, even at a very low level. It can help to keep them out of a severe deficiency state. So I often use it in place of, like, a B-complex vitamin if I have patients that are undergoing a lot of stress and we really don't see an end to it, or their stressors come and go. Using it as a maintenance product may be ongoing. And, you know, it's also determined by testing as well. So it's good to, if you've got patients on these products for an extended period of time, to go back in and retest and see where they are and to see if they need the additional pregnenolone and DHEA that is provided in the product. outside of the presence of the pregnenolone and DHEA in the product, it's really just more nutritional support for the adrenals. So, and there's a lot of different adrenal products out there, but this one specifically contains some preg and DHEA, which I think can be very useful depending on the age of the patient. If I've got somebody like in their early 20s who tend to bounce back a little bit more and have a stronger hormonal output, I may not keep them on that product for too long because, they have more of a capacity to produce those hormones. So it really comes along with your assessment of your patient and where they stand. So to give you a more finite answer, I wouldn't hesitate to keep somebody on it for a year if they were undergoing a lot of stress, and then I would retest them and see where they are.
Great. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
I have a question. Given that support that there is some pregnenolone and DHEA, if you have somebody on the drops, are you then cutting back on the amount in the drops or figuring that, only about 60% of what's in that in the oral form is going to get absorbed and then adjusting? How would you do that?
Well, yeah, I always consider that because I know that, okay, if I'm going to put them on the support adrenals, I know that they're going to get some from there. And then I usually go pretty conservatively on the drops initially because the nice thing is it's not a fixed dosage. It's not like a capsule or a tablet where it's
right.
All or nothing. You can start people out on low dosages and then have them work their way up a little bit, knowing that they're getting some base support from the support adrenals in an oral product, but adding in the drops, which gets better absorption and it's absorbed more rapidly that way. So, for example, people in a stage 3 adrenal fatigue, we often think we need to blast them with a lot of product because everything is so low. But in truth, the opposite is what you need to do. You don't want to start somebody out who's got really low cortisol and DHEA on high dosages of things because their body may not utilize it properly, and then
mm-hmm.
they may have some side effects from the products where they may get some heart palpitations or just kind of feel lightheaded or something just doesn't feel right for them. So you start them out on lower dosages of things, and then you can work them up a little bit. Always keeping in mind that they are getting some base support from the support adrenals as well.
Okay, good. And the other question that I had was related to, you didn't distinguish in terms of the protocols between stage 1, 2, and 3. You just gave general ranges. So do you have specific, like I teach specific recommendations?
That's where that's where you can go onto the Biomatrix One website.
Okay.
And access those protocols.
Yeah, and we teach
those. I felt it would be a little bit tedious to put all of that in there.
Yeah,
That to your listening audience would be kind of dull. It's more of a reference, but those are all accessible on the Biomatrix One website if you just go to the protocol section. And if you're a practitioner with an account, you can access those protocols, and it gives you more specific guidelines.
Okay, great. And the last thing I would like to ask is, do you have any special things that you do for the, you said right away start with getting them to sleep. Do you have any specific protocols that you've found work more regularly than others? I know it's all individual depending on why and how they're not sleeping.
Well, we just talked about the adrenal portion of the test, which
right.
is a 201 through the BioHealth menu. But running a 205 can be very helpful because in addition to the adrenal stress profile, you also get a measurement of the sex hormones and you get a measurement of nighttime melatonin. So that's one aspect of looking at why they're not sleeping. Is their melatonin level really low? And is their nighttime cortisol high? So assessing melatonin is helpful because it gives you a starting point from what to do.
Right.
If they have a really low melatonin, it can also direct further testing because that low melatonin may be a result of gut issues. Melatonin is produced from serotonin, and serotonin is primarily, the majority of it is produced in our digestive tract. So if you've got a lot of gut dysfunction and inflammation and just stuff going on, you may not be producing a lot of serotonin to support the production of melatonin.
Right.
So that's an important aspect to look at, which is why it's good to measure a melatonin level. As far as just treating them, treating the symptoms of not being able to sleep, I discuss a lot of sleep hygiene issues with them because a lot of it has to do with just not approaching sleep in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
People staying on computers late at night or working late or not having a nighttime routine. I know it sounds silly, but we do this with our children. We have kind of a nighttime routine to get them to sort of inch into sleep mode. And so I think it's important for adults to have that as well, where they sort of make a commitment that, you know, 45 minutes before they intend to go to bed, they turn off all electronics, they turn the lights down in the house, they maybe take a hot Epsom salt bath. They do something to induce a state of sleep, and they make a conscious effort to dissociate from the events of the day.
Yeah.
Most people can't sleep because their brain starts to spin,
right,
and they get stressed, and they, you know, basically induce cortisol production that way, mm-hmm, due to a stress response. So sleep hygiene is really important, you know, addressing other issues like light in the room and all of that. I think we can all, you know, look those things up. But as far as the protocol goes, it really depends on if it's a melatonin issue or if their brain is overstimulated. And if the brain's overstimulated, I may try some GABA and some calming herbs, like combination formulas that have some valerian and some kava and some passion flower, to try and get the brain to settle down a little bit. If it's a melatonin issue, I'm usually happy to try a little 5-HTP or even some melatonin to see if they respond to it well. If it's a hormonal issue, you know, when you have women in perimenopause and menopause, it may be that it's due to low progesterone.
Right.
Oftentimes in the early phases of perimenopause, women have adequate estrogen but inadequate progesterone.
Right.
So you just have to fill in the gaps of what is missing, and sometimes providing some progesterone will do the trick and help women to sleep better. So again, as you said, it's really an individual basis, and it also depends on what the patient or client has tried in the past.
Right.
But I think sleep hygiene issues are key to getting them to sleep successfully and consistently.
Yep, I agree. Do you know if there's any plan to bring the progesterone drops back? I used to use those a lot.
Well, they have on their supplement menu from a company called Beswecken, they have the Progon BL.
Okay.
Which is, it is a plant-based progesterone, and each drop contains 4 milligrams of progesterone. It's a liquid product that can be used either orally or topically, and it will say on the bottle to apply. But it is in a food-grade oil base, so it can be taken orally if you want to get more sublingual absorption, or it can be used topically.
That's great to know.
You know, so
yeah.
And different things work for different people. I think we can't make a blanket statement about, you know, mm-hmm, one way being the best way for everybody. I've just learned over time that different, mm-hmm, women respond to different modes of delivery. So.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah,
good to try other things.
I agree. We're very big here on the personalization and biochemical individuality, so it's really good to hear you reinforce that. And it's good to know that, because for a while I think the Beswecken wasn't available either, and I thought maybe it was good old powers that be trying to shut it down.
No, you know, what had happened for a while was they always used to have oral products. They had tableted products. And, you know, as we know, like, topicals don't always work for people.
Right.
Swallowing them orally doesn't always work for people. But they always had their products in a tableted form. But the FDA, I think, made them change their formulation so that it could be applied topically.
Okay.
But, you know, they understand the value in administering hormones in different ways. So they put it in a food-grade oil base so that it could be used either way.
Good. So it's kind of a way to get around it, it sounds like.
Yeah, kind of a way to get around it. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say without saying it.
Oops. We'll delete that off the video, off the
recording.
But that's good. That's smart. Because that was a very popular product, and all of a sudden we couldn't get it anymore. And then I tried to get it through Beswecken and look it around, and I couldn't find it anywhere. So that's good to know.
Yeah, it's around.
Good.
It's back.
Yay.
It is on the Biomatrix One website, and they also have their Phyto BL, which is a combination of plant-based estriol and progesterone.
Oh, and that's phyto what? Phyto?
Yeah, phyto B.
Phyto B. Okay,
got it. Phyto B. Phyto B. Yeah.
Okay, great, great. All right. So I think that's all the questions. I'm going to check and see if anybody typed any questions in. If you have any questions to type in, I see there's a bunch of you that are on the webcast. But it looks like I think you were clear enough to really, you know, no questions. So thank you.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here. And for everybody, this has been an adrenal presentation with Dr. Tracy Trancatella.
Yes, Trancatella.
Good. Dr. Tracy Trancatella. And you all have access to the BioHealth for ordering the tests. And I know some of you have started to do that, but you have an account through my account that you can order through. And I think with Biomatrix, they should be able to get, should they be able to set up an account to order from Biomatrix?
You know, that's more of a customer service question.
Okay.
And so they can call customer service. I think that it's not going to be an issue just to be able to access the protocols and the products. So that just needs to be done through customer service, or you can go, I think you can do it directly online.
Okay. Yeah. So biomatrix1.com, and you guys know are familiar with them because we've been recommending them as we went through our various cases. So thank you again, and we'll be talking again soon. Bye-bye, everyone.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.